Follow the Law with Robots, the podcast for news and views on robotics. Hi, I'm Sabine.
Hi, and I'm Amanda. Welcome to the 60th episode of Robots.
Did you ever wonder who is responsible if your robot car drives you into a wall or if your Roomba runs over your hamster?
Did you ever think about what privacy you might be losing if robots have access to all areas of your homes?
Did you ever consider the legal challenges that might come up if robots are as intelligent as us?
Well, in this episode, we'll be talking about these issues touching on ethics, robotics, and the law with expert Ryan Kalo, who is a senior research fellow at Stanford Law School.
We'll then be holding a poll to ask you what rights intelligent robots should have. But first, as always, let's listen to the latest news in robotics from Christine.
Thanks, Sabine. This week, both the New York Times and our friends over at IEEE Spectrum's Automaton blog have run special series on telepresence robots. Apart from research projects in various stages, a number of companies, including Anybots, Vigo Communications, PAL Robotics, Robodynamics, and Willow Garage, offer commercial telepresence solutions for a variety of applications, from replacing static video conferencing systems all the way to telemedicine. The two series highlight advantages of telepresence robots over traditional video telephony, which mainly hinge on the very different reaction of people to a moving entity as opposed to a face on a static screen, but also show the many challenges that remain, such as acceptance of this radically new technology in the work environment, or seemingly simple obstacles like closed doors that can prove unsurmountable obstacles for the armless telepresence robots. All things considered, telepresence looks like it's set for a bright future on Earth, but also in space. On November 1st, NASA will launch its Robonaut 2 humanoid aboard Space Shuttle Discovery to take up its permanent residence on the International Space Station to work alongside humans as a robotic helper. Carnegie Mellon University's Biorobotics Lab has demonstrated how its snakebot can climb a tree and look around. As pointed out by Howie Chosett in his interview with Robots Podcast last October, snake robots offer unsurpassed potential for slithering, sliding, squeezing, or climbing into places that people and other types of robots can't reach due to their many degrees of freedom. A video shows the robot approaching the tree in rough terrain, slinging its body around it, then using rotating modules to climb up the trunk, and finally, taking up a perching position that allows it to move its head to observe the surroundings. The researchers are now working on climbing tree trunks with different widths and to navigate over branches. For more information on telepresence robots and Carnegie Mellon University SnakeBot, visit our forum at www.robotspodcast.com/forum.
Thanks, Christine. Ryan Kalo is a senior research fellow at Stanford and expert in robots and the law. As such, he's been part of numerous international committees thinking about the implications of robots in our societies. His forte resides in considering liability issues companies face when commercializing robots and privacy issues that creep up when robots enter our everyday lives. With his limitless knowledge in robotics and the rhetoric of a lawyer, he no doubt brings up questions that will have you scratching your head for a while. Hi, Ryan. Welcome to Robots.
Hi, Sabine. Thanks for having me.
Can you please present yourself to our listeners?
Sure. I'm a senior research fellow at Stanford Law School Center for Internet and Society, and there I focus on privacy and on robotics.
What's it like working on law and robotics at Stanford?
Well, you know, it's really great because there is so much going on with respect to robotics at Stanford University as a whole. And so you have folks at the Center for Automotive Research at Stanford who are working on autonomous vehicles. You have folks in the Stanford AI Lab. Really some just premier robotics stuff is going on here. And you have a world-class law, really a world-class law school in Stanford Law School where I work. And so it's a wonderful combination because I can just walk over and talk to folks who are really building these things and run ideas by them and talk to them. If you look at other major U.S. places where robots are being built, MIT, Carnegie Mellon, they don't have law schools. And so I'm really happy working here at Stanford because of the greater community. Incidentally, also, Silicon Valley is rapidly becoming a worldwide center for robotics. There are so many companies here from Willow Garage to Anybot and Nito and Adept, SRI, that are actually building robots here in the Silicon Valley, that it's even great just to have access to that. So I'm very happy to be working here in particular.
Why are you interested in robotics?
Well, I think that robotics are going to be the transformative technology of this century in much the same way as computers were in the 80s, as the Internet was in the 90s and leading up until now. I think that the next logical progression is into robotics as being the truly transformative technology of our time.
And how is robotics different from other technologies from a law perspective?
That's a great question. So one of the really interesting differences between robots and, say, computers or software is that robots have actuators. They can touch you, right? So this is a definition that gets tossed around a lot. I think it appears in Singer's book, Wired for War, the idea being that a robot is something that has three components, a sensor, a processor, and an actuator. It has a sensor to differentiate it from something that is like a computer. It has to be able to determine the world around it, to think about the world around it. A processor because it can't just be a remote control car, and an actuator because it can't just be a computer with a camera. But the difference, of course, between a computer and a robot is that a robot can actually physically touch you. And so whereas you can't sue Microsoft Word because it crashes and you lose your term paper, the law will think very differently when a crash or a problem in software or hardware ends up actually having a physical, tangible result in reality. And so I think the law is going to treat robots very, very differently, and specifically because of this issue about actuators.
This question of robots in the law seems to be a rather new topic. Can you give us an overview of what's already been done and how this field is progressing?
Absolutely. So in a sense, the field of robotics in the law is a very new and emerging one. Another related field, something that you covered in previous podcasts actually quite well, has to do with roboethics. And so roboethics is this notion of ethical and social ramifications of robotics. And that's been going on for quite some time, maybe a decade, where a few people have been working in that space, thinking about the ethical ramifications of this technology. People thinking specifically about robots in law, well, again, that also has been around in bits and pieces. And so you have works like Frankenstein Unbound by the communications professor Lehman Wilzig, actually, from years and years ago. You have a great piece on artificial intelligence in the law by Lawrence Solom from a few years back, but it's all bits and pieces, and I think it's starting to gel now as a distinct discipline, people thinking about it, and sometimes it's happening under the umbrella of so-called roboethics, which is this national movement, and sometimes it's just people writing law review articles, people writing traditional legal opinions that actually intersect with robotics.
Are there any concrete organizations?
There are a bunch of them. I mean, so for instance, within robotics and the law, there is a section of the American Bar Association, which is the big association that many lawyers belong to, that is specifically devoted to robotics and artificial intelligence. In fact, this year I'll be co-chairing that particular body. And then there are a bunch of groups and organizations that have begun to think about this. There's, for instance, a working group in Europe thinking about autonomous vehicles and policy. There's a working group starting up in the United States here in Silicon Valley that's also thinking about autonomous vehicles and policy. And then, as I said, there's a whole roboethics community that is meeting more and more regularly. For instance, I just had an interesting call for papers from Wendell Wallach actually sent it along, but I think that's being organized by Dr. Vanderberg of Tilburg University in the Netherlands, the Institute for Law, Technology, and Society, that is actually looking at both neuroscience and robotics, and specifically at the legal questions there. And so that's really, it's something that's starting to gel and starting to organize more basically. But historically, interesting, the robotics associations have been made up primarily of engineers, and then later you started to get people like Wendell Wallach and Patrick Lind, philosophers and sociologists and the like, Neil Sharkey and some others. And now finally, the lawyers are always the last of the party, but now you have people like myself, like Ken Anderson at American. Some of my colleagues here at Stanford are thinking about robotics. Ian Kerr in Canada. Trained lawyers who are thinking about these issues are finally coming into the picture.
Why do you think it takes longer to get the lawyers into the picture?
In a sense, lawyers are always sort of perennially behind the times, right? In the sense that one of the moves that legal scholarship you see quite a bit, and this is not to disparage legal scholarship, it's a really rich and interesting and fertile area, and obviously I've dedicated my career to legal scholarship, and I really enjoy it. But one of the things you see quite a bit is that there will be an insight or an issue that's developed in another discipline, and that tool or that set of issues will then come into the law. But in a sense, lawyers are intrinsically conservative, right? I mean, there's enough legal problems today for us to be chewing on. You don't want to be overly speculative about what's going on in the future. There's actually an interesting doctrine that your listeners might not know about, which is called ripeness, okay? And so ripeness is this notion in the courts that they're not going to take a case if the issues in the case are not ripe for consideration. That is, they haven't matured to the point where it's worthwhile weighing in. And that mindset, in a sense, permeates some legal scholarship. Now, that said, there are some very, very forward-looking legal scholars out there, among them Jonathan Zittrain, Lawrence Lessig, Barbara Venshevic in technology. I mean, all these people are very forward-looking in a sense. But there is a sense in which there's a sort of essential conservatism to legal scholarship. And I think that's why robotics hasn't been widely discussed. Although, again, there are specific instances where people have written on the ramifications for law of artificial intelligence and of robotics. It's good solid scholarship. It just hasn't reached a critical mass, I guess. One thing I'd like to differentiate is within legal scholarship, there's sort of two kinds of strains going on. One of them has to do with what are the legal ramifications of this new technology? So how will robotics be treated differently, and how should the law react to it? What problems might robotics bring up that previous technologies have not? How can we learn from precedent? Another one has to do with how do we apply techniques of artificial intelligence to the law? That is, there's some very interesting work being done at Stanford at the Codex Project, here at the law school, about how do we automate legal services, for instance? How do we bring to bear artificial intelligence on legal problems? And that's a very distinct, well-defined area where artificial intelligence at least intersects with the law and has for some time. So again, it's scattershot, but the movement is starting to congeal, I think.
Well, we're very happy you're looking at the questions, and I wanted to start by thinking about liability. When you have an industrial robot or a Roomba, who's responsible for this robot?
So that's interesting. So there's actually just to start a little earlier than that. So there's been a couple places where robotics has really flourished, and one of them is in industry, that is to say, in manufacturing, and another one is in war. You see really thousands and thousands of robots and many more on the way in the theater of war. So these are two places that robots have flourished, and if you look closely at those two places, interestingly, from a lawyer's perspective, they have built-in immunity for something going wrong. Okay, so in industry context, in the manufacturing context, if something goes wrong with the robot, there's often in place a so-called workers' compensation scheme, which just says no matter what goes wrong in the factory or job place, this kind of insurance that you take out through the state called workers' compensation will compensate the individual. And so you end up getting rid of some cases and some instances of litigation just on the basis that, hey, it's covered by that. Similarly, in wartime or in military applications, often there is immunity for manufacturers of robotics when they're government contracted, because the specifications are such that basically you're just delivering exactly what the government asked for, and therefore the law considers that you'll be immune in the event that there's a problem. So that has to do with sort of the issue of who pays. As to who's responsible, there's sort of two boxes that I want robotics to get out of, and I think that it'll present legal challenges. One of those boxes is physical, that is to say, almost geographic. Let's get robotics out of the factory, out of the military context, and get them out into the general public, so that they're just as successful and prolific in the personal service space as they are in the manufacturing and war space. So these are the physical constraints in terms of where they are. And the other one, though, is functional, right? So interestingly, about the Roomba. The Roomba only does one thing, right? I mean, we can talk a little bit about the iCreate platform that iRobot has come up with, and I hope to talk about that. But the Roomba only does one thing. You know, it cleans your floor, vacuums your floor. So if the Roomba doesn't vacuum your floor, or in the process of vacuuming your floor, it causes damage or it hurts someone, then iRobot is clearly responsible, because they've built something that only does one thing, and when it doesn't do that thing, then they're responsible. Just as if they were to build a hairdryer and the hairdryer were not to dry your hair effectively, or if the hairdryer were to short circuit and burn your hand, then it would be clearly the responsibility of the manufacturer. But let's think about instead a platform like another one that you covered on this podcast. It's like the Now. Or look at the platform that iRobot has come up with, because so many people wanted to tinker with the Roomba that they created this platform and this manual for how to hack into this iCreate, which is basically just a Roomba without the cleaning functionality, and people have done all kinds of neat things with it. Then all of a sudden, people are doing things where they are programming the robot. They're instructing it. They're writing the software. They're running it. And then all of a sudden, it becomes less obvious who's responsible. The manufacturer has just given you a platform, and then you are using it in all these innovative and great ways. So I think the very best of robotics is something that breaks out of the physical constraints or the physical context of manufacturing and military, but also breaks out of the functional limitation of only doing one thing. I think we want robots that can do anything that the end user, the customer, can imagine. We want it to be like the internet. We want it to be like computers, where you can run any software, where you can do any application. But once you start getting in there, into that realm where it's the end user who's innovating, it's the individual who's innovating, then you start to run into these difficult legal questions. The way we've been able to domesticate that issue with computers and the internet, which also are open in this way and multifaceted and multifunctional in this way, is that we've been able, the courts, and to some extent the Congress of the United States, have actually domesticated the issue by saying, look, the companies are not responsible for what individuals do with these platforms, right? So again, back to my earlier point, you can't sue Microsoft Word because it ate your term paper. That's because it's really difficult to determine whether it was something that you did that caused the software glitch, whether it was something about the operating systems, about the hardware. You can't really parse those things out. But at the end of the day, something called the economic loss doctrine comes into play, which is this notion that you can only recover the value of the software that you purchased and any information that you made with it, even though it's, you know, even though your term paper is much more valuable to you than the software that you bought out of the box, your recovery is limited under the law to that, to what you paid for the software, because the idea of the information that you made with it is subsumed within it. Similarly with the internet, if you say something about me, at least in the United States, on Facebook that ends up being defamatory, meaning that it's legally actionable because it's this, you know, false malicious thing that you said about me that's damaging to me, you can't sue Facebook, the platform. You have to sue the individual who made the comment. And that's not an accident. That's because of Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act, which immunizes platforms for what users do. So fast forward to robotics behaving the same way. The law won't react the same when the injury is not information. The law will react differently. And so when you program your cool new robot that you bought to pick up, something in the, pick up leaves in the yard, and it ends up, God forbid, you know, running into a neighborhood dog, that physical injury will not be treated the same way. And we have instances of that in a lot of places. For instance, where computers have physical effects, like where they modulate the amount of radiation you get in tests, in medical tests that require radiation, and they over-radiate the patient, then you can sue them and you get traction. When they guide systems like airplane systems and there's a malfunction, then you can recover. And so that same dynamic could well play out in robotics, and I worry that it will stop us from getting robots out of the factory where immunity is already there, out of the military where immunity is there, and also not provide an incentive for people to make great robots that can do anything, and rather they'll just do one thing, like vacuum your floor, and then the company can be responsible for all the parameters of that.
I agree, these liability issues are really holding back some technologies. I'm thinking of autonomous cars, medical robots, caretakers. What do you think is needed then to actually overcome this problem?
Right. That's interesting. So, yeah, there are very specific instances that you can point to, both with robotics today and in previous technologies, where the functionality is quite limited. I understand anecdotally. I speak often to a reporter who's a Japanese reporter who covers robotics, and I've spoken to a couple of folks working on medical robot technology. And my understanding actually is that some robotic technology in Japan, where robots are relatively flourishing, has been limited because it's very difficult for them to get through the approval process for medical applications. And so some really innovative, neat robotic surgery and those kind of devices are not making it through. In the United States, you have previous examples like the general aviation. So this is like small planes. This is sort of Cessna and that kind of thing, where the industry was completely shut down because people were getting sued so much when there were crashes. And in fact, Congress had to intervene and pass a law, the General Aviation Rehabilitation Act, I think it is, that immunized manufacturers for certain kinds of things. So what do I think is needed? I actually think that we're going to need to step in and provide immunity for manufacturers for what users do with robots. I think that if you buy a robot and it comes with software out of the box and you use it with that software, then in keeping with that and most of the university of those uses, then I think that the manufacturer should be responsible. But if you start modifying your robot, tinkering with the hardware of it, if you start to run software on it that's not the stuff that came with it, you know, or you modify the software because it's open source and that kind of thing, then I think that you should cease to be able to sue the manufacturer in that instance. And that's very similar in a way to how we treat internet content, where we don't sue the platform for what users do. And then number two, I think that we should immunize robotic manufacturers for safety measures that they put in place, which in 99% of the time result in safer robots, but in 1% of the time end up being harmful in a situation. That is, in the absence of that safety feature, the robot would not have caused a harm. We see that, for instance, in the airbag context in cars, right? So airbags are much safer than not airbags, but in a narrow context, that of children and particularly short people, airbags ended up being deleterious. And so there was a real concern about with the viability of airbags in light of litigation, and they had to be sorted out. So I really see two kinds of immunity being important here. One, for what people do with their, what innovative, cool uses you put your robots, and then number two, for safety designs. Now, one issue people always bring up is, well, how do you expect people to be able to buy a robot and then use it if they themselves, the consumer, have to be liable for it? Well, there I think the answer is pretty simple. You just buy a very small amount of insurance, because in most instances, no one's going to be wreaking a lot of havoc with their personal or service robot. It's only in the very narrow instance that something's going to go wrong. And so I think an insurance industry will naturally come up where, you know, maybe you buy a cool robot, you know, you spend a lot of money on it, $600-$700, it's very versatile, you can run any kind of software on it, and then you pay a few dollars a month. So in the unlikely event that that it hits the neighbor's dog, there's insurance in place. But I think that that cost has to be on the consumer and modulated on the basis of how aggressive the consumer is going to be with robot applications.
Do you think it makes sense to have some sort of moral or legal rules that every robot needs to follow, some sort of Asimov rules?
Yeah, so, you know, there's some really interesting work being done by Ron Arkin at Georgia Tech, right? And so he's much more in the roboethics space, I suppose, than in the robot law space, where he's trying to come up with a kind of software protocol that will basically emulate guilt, so that and this is for military robots. The idea there is that robots will understand under what conditions they can exert lethal or non-lethal force, and then they can sort of learn from their quote-unquote mistakes. And the hope is that ultimately robotic soldiers will be even better at limiting casualties as ordinary soldiers. Ken Anderson interestingly points out today, the use of drones actually ends up with less collateral damage than when attacks are targeted than when you have to go into full-fledged bombing, you know, mortar shelling, that kind of thing, or sending a bunch of soldiers in. And so there's already a sense in which targeted killing may even be limiting collateral damage. But Arkin's hope is that it will be further limited by software. So that sort of thing, I think, is viable. The idea that you can program in a conscience into a robot, the sort of Asimovian idea, I think that's very far away from actual application. I think that for now, the most we could do is set in to place a couple of restrictions, very simple restrictions, like cannot leave this area and have like a bounded area perhaps of your home, or so that the robot doesn't wander off. Very simple commands like that. You know, automatically shut down if, you know, you hear a yell of pain. You know, things like those would be able to put in. But those aren't really ethical boundaries. They're just knee-jerk sort of safety features that we program in. I think we're very far away from a place where we're really able to program a kind of consciousness into an operating system that then would have would end up having an ethical dimension.
Yeah, I'm just thinking it's some sort of stamp on your robot which could say certified safe based on some organization could help a lot in the process, and maybe that could be a basis for setting immunity or something like that.
You know, that's an interesting idea, that there would be some kind of standards. And I think at one level there could be. That is, there could be design specifications that said your robot's arm can exert no more than this much force, or it must have this safety feature, or it must be made out of this material. But note that if as what I'm calling the very best of robotics, it turns out to be something that is multifunctional, that literally nobody knows in advance what all the incredibly neat applications are going to be that people put their robots to. I mean, even today, no one could anticipate necessarily that you'd be able to hack a Roomba and make it turn it into a Pac-Man machine. Or I saw recently someone who made a crib that rocked the baby to sleep. I don't advocate that. That seems a little bit dangerous. But the point is that there's all these incredible applications that people are putting together. A standards body would not be able to anticipate them in advance. And so it wouldn't be able to certify a robot for safety because of all the variables. I mean, you know, I'm told by computer scientists, which I'm not one, but I'm told by them, that it actually turns out to be impossible 100% to debug even simple software, because you just can't anticipate all the parameters of use, and you can't anticipate the interactions with the operating system and with the hardware. So certifying robots as safe, I think, would be very, very difficult. Although I do agree that there could be a baseline of safety standards and material standards that would go a long way toward, you know, not having, like, you know, completely irresponsibly unsafe robots with jagged edges and overly strong arms or et cetera.
Let's look at privacy. What type of challenge does robotics bring in this area?
So let's say that the world that I'm sort of hoping for of widespread personal and service robots, you know, robots in hospitals, robots in offices, robots in homes, artificial intelligence applications in cars, et cetera, et cetera. Let's say that actually occurs. Well, I actually think that one of the main issues that we'll need to grapple with once we get to this world that I'm hoping for, I should say, really hoping for, is the issue of privacy. I think that robotics presents an enormous danger around privacy along at least three specific lines. Number one, as I believe that robotics will and has, frankly, enormously increased our capacity for surveillance. You know, one of the chief ways that we've used robots outside of, you know, say manufacturing, has turned out to be in the service of surveillance. So on the battlefield, drones of all sizes keep tabs on you know, villages and battlefields and everything else. And some of those same applications are being brought back to do domestic law enforcement. Lee Tian, a privacy expert at the Electronic Frontier Foundation, pointed this out to me. That's often the progression. You have a technology that gets deployed in the military context, and then it comes in, and usually it starts at the border of a nation, and so it's used to police a border, and then eventually it makes it inland into the domestic law enforcement context. So that's my concern about things like, you know, drones of all sizes. And if you think about the fact that it's not just, you know, the sort of standard predator drone or something like that we're worried about. There's these enormous drones that stay afloat, adrift in the air, let's say, for long, long periods of time and are very, very far away, you know, thousands of feet away, so that they can't be seen by the people on the ground. And then they have these telescopic photo capabilities, and they can just sort of hover over an area and keep tabs on it. It's sort of like a CCTV, you know, closed-circuit television on steroids, all the way down to very, very, very tiny robots that can land on a power line to recharge, that can perch on your windowsill. You have robots that are steered by flies, I have read recently, or you have robots that are actually, in a sense, organisms that have been taken over neurologically to guide them, so cockroaches or flying insects, and mounted with cameras. These are sort of initiatives that are being explored by U.S. defense funding. You know, you have robots that can flatten themselves and change shape. I mean, it's really so-called jamming technology, so that they could be able to squeeze through spaces or fit under doors. And I don't want to be paranoid here, but already a lot of these robotic applications are being used for surveillance. And so I'm concerned that with the prevalence of robots, just the government or even private industry will be much better at surveilling people. That was a little long-winded, but let me try to be shorter on the other two. So the other way I think that robots can implicate privacy is because they will allow access to historically private spaces. So if we end up bringing robots into our home, well, perhaps someone will be able to access that robot. Now, that might happen because they get hacked, and there's work out of the University of Washington by Tamara Denning and Tadayoshi Kono that has shown that commercially available robots like the Rovio can actually be hacked remotely through the Internet. So if they can connect to the Internet, people can find them and hack into them. And then not only can they get video and audio footage of your home in that instance, but in addition, they can actually move the robot around to what they want to see. You could even imagine a very sophisticated hacker being able to find the spare key and drop it out of the mailbox, right? I mean, these sorts of attacks. But also the government will be able to access robotic sensory feeds if they're in the home or in the office or in the car. Really, the golden rule in surveillance law in the United States is that the government can get anything with sufficient process. So if they get a wiretap, if they fulfill the warrant requirement of the Fourth Amendment and the warrant requirement of the Wiretap Act, the government would literally be able to take over a robot and use it to surveil the interior of the home. And so it's those sort of access issues that where we start to bring something that has a camera, that has a variety of sensors, in some cases sensors that human beings simply don't possess, like fMRI or sonar or LIDAR, all kinds of other sensory equipment that humans just don't have that spectrum, all of a sudden that information could be accessed. And then the third and final way, and I think this is in many ways the most interesting challenge, is that we are just hardwired to perceive anthropomorphic technology like robots, to perceive them as though a person were really there. Right, so there's this extensive literature, sometimes referred to as computers as social actors, which shows that, you know, we respond to flattery by robots as though a person were flattering us. We cooperate with them. We keep promises to robots, but not to less anthropomorphic technology. And this propensity to treat social machines as though they were really people extends to the feeling of being observed and evaluated. Right, so there's all these experiments that show things like people will pay more for coffee on the honor system if there's a picture of eyes as opposed to a picture of flowers. People will skip sensitive questions on a questionnaire if the interface feels social, that is, talks to you, looks like a face. Just on and on and on and on. So imagine now that we have all these robots that present socially, because of course many robots are trying to be as sort of social as possible so as to be better accepted and to be more salient. You know, at Carnegie Mellon, just as a quick anecdote, at Carnegie Mellon they built this nurse bot. When they initially built the nurse bot, this is a bot to help the elderly and patients and such, they introduced it to an elderly a community, and it didn't look very much like a person. It was just like a sort of a box, right? It was a very sort of boxy-looking, machine-looking. It had this very robot-like, you know, sort of quintessential robot voice. And it would remind patients to take their pills, and it would tell them to do other things, exercise and that kind of thing. And the community completely ignored it. And then they decided to make it more anthropomorphic, you know, put a face on it, make its voice more natural. And all of a sudden, everybody started to respond to it. And so there's a real need for robots to be accepted, for them to be, and salient for them to be anthropomorphic. But then perhaps that will interrupt our solitude, right? So maybe we don't necessarily think of a robot as being a person intellectually, and so we have it around in one's office, in one's house, in one's car, or even a disembodied voice or other kinds of interfaces that are social in nature. Where are opportunities for us to be alone? Where, one of the chief things that privacy protects is these so-called moments off stage, in Alan Weston's famous privacy scholar's words, these times when we can be away from everyone. We'll never necessarily feel like we're away from people if we have technology in our lives that feels to us like a person. And so in those three ways, at least, I think that robots will have deep implications for privacy, and I hope that roboticists and others begin to tackle them in the near term.
So the first two, I have the feeling, can have a solution from a legal front, so basically trying to put something into place. But the third one is mostly a software issue, so a practical issue. People will have to put the limits themselves, I think.
You're absolutely right. So you can imagine ways that we can domesticate the first two problems, right? So one, you know, if we're worried about excessive surveillance, what do? We put limits on the way robots can be used by law enforcement. We interpret the Fourth Amendment of the Constitution, which is in the United States, it's the guarantee against unreasonable searches and seizures by the government. This is the notion that the government can't just go into your house or look at your files. It has to have probable cause. We can set high bars there. We can introduce federal laws like the Electronic Communications Privacy Act and make sure that they cover robots in the home. We can place obligations on manufacturers to make robots that can't be hacked, just as we might be moving into with respect to computers and such. So, yeah, there are some pretty obvious solutions with the first two categories of direct surveillance and access. But this third category of the way that we're just sort of hardwired to react, I mean, that is a really, really tough issue, and it's going to require just a reorientation, not only by roboticists, but also by the consumer. Because if you think about it from the classic stance of privacy law, one of the things that always defeats, or almost always defeats, a privacy claim is that there's consent. That is, if you consent to be photographed, if you consent to have someone listen to your conversation, to record your conversation, then you know the law is not too concerned about you. If you go out in public and someone takes a photo of you, there's not much in the way of privacy in public under U.S. law. But here, the privacy invasion, as I've cast it, is arguably invited. In fact, it's purchased, right? People pay good money to have these things in their lives. And it's hardwired, it's subconscious, its effects are not easy to measure. And so that makes it very, very, very difficult to sort of understand. And I want to say this. I mean, I think that many people that are thinking about robot ethics, I was reading the Springer Handbook of Robotics, the most recent version, and there's a chapter on roboethics. And one of the things that the authors cover is privacy. And I think there are folks who are thinking about privacy in robotics, but I think that they're thinking about it in a more narrow way. They're thinking about it in terms of the fact that robots can collect and process and disseminate information. They're not thinking about the effect of these robots on people more directly just because of the way that we experience them. And so I think that if we start to think about that and think about how can we preserve the conditions, how can we preserve solitude, and how can we make sure that people don't perceive robots eventually to be invasive or have these secondary effects. But I agree. I think it's going to be an extraordinarily difficult and maybe even just totally non-legal question for us to face in the next 10 years or so.
It's really a very interesting question. I hadn't really thought of this aspect. I have the feeling it's going to be like the cell phone or like any other technology, where before we didn't have our cell phones with us all the time. We weren't accessible all the time. And in the end, we just get used to it.
Absolutely. I mean, so think about, just to drill down a little bit here, and I think that this insight applies not just to robots, but it also applies to artificial intelligence or low-level AI systems. Once upon a time, when you conducted a search of the internet or something, right? You know, the way it is today, I guess, not once upon a time, but right now, you go and you have this informal text box, right? And you type in your query, and then you get a list of links. It's a very, informal transaction. It's sort of like, I'm just plugging in the numbers and I'm getting back results, or I'm plugging in the words and I'm getting back results. But if you look at systems like Siri, which was developed by Stanford Research Institute, SRI, and recently purchased by Apple, this is an application that doesn't just rely on you to, type in a query. It actually interacts with you socially, right? It wants to know. You can tell it things. You can say, I want to go to dinner with so and so at this place. There's a lot of human-computer interaction technology that is moving towards the social aspect because it's so salient to people. It's so, on one level, it's like really neat and really comfortable and really grabs people's attention and gets them to work with the technology better. But then, of course, there's a different quality to searches that you conduct through something that feels like a person. It's like you're trying to research some, condition that you feel you might have medically and that's embarrassing. And instead of being able to go on the internet and just search for it in the privacy of your home without feeling like anyone's looking over your shoulder, you have to go hand the query to a librarian on the old card system, and they look at it and say, oh, you want to know about, X? And then they go and they find it. I mean, it's a really different kind of transaction. And so I think it creeps into lots of different spaces. But I agree. My concern is that, we won't think about it. It won't be so obvious. It won't be so immediate, so salient. And then one day, all of a sudden, you'll just sort of see the fruits of the fact that no one ever feels like they're by themselves because they have these robotic companions, which, by the way, I'm a huge robot booster. I really want to see robot proliferation. I think it's a wonderful thing. I also have no objection to, ethically or otherwise, to design robots in the way that's the most attractive and the most helpful and engaging. But I worry about these effects, these secondary effects that might not be so easy to trace or avoid. Another interesting dimension that has to do with the social meaning of robots is the fact that we might end up behaving toward robots in ways that are much more sensitive than we do towards ordinary appliances, right? So no one really cares when you use your washing machine. No one really cares when you use your dryer. What you do with these things is limited and not meaningful, not socially meaningful. But if we get these robots into our homes that we think of as being social entities, and we can program them in all different ways, you know, and if the history of technology is any lesson here, then some of those ways will be quite controversial. I'm thinking of the very popular game in Japan where there's these virtual girlfriends and people get super invested and take them on vacation. If we end up having these kinds of interactions that are social with robots, that's going to be a really different interaction than with an ordinary machine and be very sensitive. And meanwhile, it probably will be recorded. And so there's this sort of social meaning and the way that we use robots will be very, very different. And unlike a human interaction with among two people, there'll be a record of it. The transcript of a conversation at night between a lonely person and a robot might read like the notes of a psychologist, right? I mean, this is really sensitive information potentially. Not to lay it on too thick. I mean, I understand that there are ways to avoid this and that there are other many benefits, but these are sort of the things that at the privacy side of my brain, if there is one, keeps up at night.
So I want to really look into the far future. Let's imagine that we have robots who are conscious, smart, have emotions, who are very similar to humans. At that point, should we be making a difference in the law between what a human is and what a robot is?
You know, that's a great question. It's one that I don't think about as much just because I think it's so far into the future, and I think there are some lower-hanging fruit that we need to deal with before we get to that point. That said, people have looked at this already and have begun to make suggestions about how we might treat a conscious-seeming, at least, robot. And there's a bunch of different models out there that have less or more sort of attraction in terms of, you know, sort of intellectual coherence. One of them is to sort of treat robots like children, where they have some rights, but some of their rights are subsumed within their parents, and in this case, the robot owner or guardian. There are people think about slave law and whether robots are akin to slaves, and of course, slave law is intrinsically distasteful because slavery is intrinsically distasteful, but some people believe that there are some insights we might be able to gain there. Other people look to animal law in terms of assessing responsibility. But this would be the first time where you'd have consciousness in a non-human entity. It would absolutely be, just unprecedented. Again, I think it's very, very far away. I mean, so this depends in many ways on artificial intelligence, much more so than robotic hardware. But, the term artificial intelligence was coined at my alma mater, undergraduate at Dartmouth College, 50 years ago, 60 years ago. 50, 60 years later, artificial intelligence is about as smart as insects, as my friend Marianne Williams has pointed out to me. And although we're making leaps and bounds and people are trying to sort of model a cat brain and people are excited about the possibility of rapid acceleration of that process, to me it feels very, very, very distant. But one interesting thing is that we don't need autonomous agents to be conscious in order for them to be legally relevant, right? So one of the things that happened in the United States, I don't know if your listeners were aware of this, but a couple of months ago, there was this really weird drop in the stock market, right? Suddenly, everybody was just like holding their breath because there was a precipitous drop in the American stock market. And when they started to, and which, by the way, quickly recovered, 20 minutes later, it was back up to where it had been. When they looked to try to figure out and parse exactly what had gone wrong and what had caused this drop, it became more and more clear that there was a role of these autonomous trading agents, that is to say, these programs that were taught to sort of automatically buy and sell given certain conditions. And there was just some bug. I mean, not that, you know, something happened where all of them made assumptions that ended up not being valid. And there's so many of them operating that they drove down the market. That's a very serious, I mean, the market dipping that much in that short of time, that's a very serious thing, right? And people, like, jump out of buildings over that kind of thing. And so, you know, that sort of problem is really in the much closer future. Another example is I referred earlier to a piece by Lawrence Solom, who's at the University of Illinois. He's a law professor, famous for constitutional law, but has written a great piece on artificial intelligence, where he asks, could artificial intelligence be the trustee, the executor of an estate? And it turns out that to be the executor of an estate, that is to say, the person who is responsible for executing a trust, being responsible for the estate under the law, it turns out you don't need to be conscious. You just need to be able to sort of tick off these certain legally relevant requirements. And he speculated that actually even artificial intelligence as it stands today might be capable of serving as a executor of a trust. So there's many, many ways in which artificial intelligence at least will be, you know, and I think eventually robotics will be legally relevant, and we'll have to think about what the, you know, what, how much personhood we attribute to them, and think about their rights and responsibilities, even way before we get to this question of conscious robots. I mean, at that point, if ever I were convinced, you know, I suppose sort of, I don't know if it's a Turing plus test, but if I were ever convinced that a machine had that human level intelligence and consciousness, I know that I personally would agitate for the full panoply of rights. I mean, I cannot imagine a reason to distinguish between the two. But I think that that's so far away that I'm not even sure it'll happen in my lifetime. It's exciting. I hope it does, but I'm not sure.
I love your example of a robot taking care of an estate. There's also the case of a robot marrying people in Japan. To what extent can the robots themselves be responsible for their actions?
Yeah, so, I mean, again, I think today and in the near future, the robots will not be responsible for their own actions. Somebody will always be there, you know, on the other side pulling the strings. And even if the idea is, you know, I built something that I'm just going to let loose. I built a bot that I don't have to actually puppet remotely. I built a robot that is able to recharge itself and able to conduct itself in a seemingly fully autonomous way. If something goes wrong, I still think we'll go back to the person that put that into motion. I really do. I mean, there's an example that I like to use, which is that in some instances, robots and artificial intelligence have actually come up with patentable inventions, right? So there's a kind of toothbrush that reportedly was invented by a algorithm. I mean, you know what I mean? And so, and really truly by the algorithm. I mean, the idea was we put in a bunch of parameters and the thing just said, you know, it thought about it in a way and it came up with a better design for, you know, a mousetrap, but in this case, a better design for a toothbrush. Still, the patent holder is not the autonomous agent right here, or it's not the software algorithm. The patent holder is the individual or set of individuals who built it. I think we're still in that land for a long, long time. I really do. You know, and I think the most interesting questions become questions where people release something into the wild where they don't fully expect what they don't really know what's going to happen. Because it turns out that in recovery in the United States, at least, and probably in other legal systems, foreseeability of a problem is a huge deal, whether or not you saw it coming. And it doesn't have to be the exact way it happened, just, you know, did you see the possibility of some injury here? And if you did, the likelihood is higher that someone will be able to recover. But this is really, really hard with, you know, the more autonomous robots get. How could you possibly predict? One of the great suggestions I've heard in recent times was in a 2007 report to Congress about the future of robotics in the United States. And the report was talking about getting a handle on making robots to be as socially acceptable as possible when they move out of the factories and the battlefield, as I mentioned. And one of the ideas that was floated was a robot city. Okay, so this is a city where everybody signs up. It's like the Truman Show. I don't know if you've ever seen the Truman Show, that movie, but the idea is everybody's on board, right? Everybody signs a waiver. They want to live among robots. And then people just bring their robots and they see how they do, you know? And that's the kind of thing we're going to need in order to field test these things, because it's just not going to be easy to predict the behavior once these machines get very complex. The other thing, I think, again, is this notion of the way that we heavily anthropomorphize robots. I mean, how do you handle a situation where a soldier risks his or her life in the battlefield to stop the pack bot from getting shelled? You know, I mean, whose responsibility is that, right? Is it the military for failing to train? Is it iRobot for building something that could be construed anthropomorphic? I mean, you know, it's really hard to parse these sort of things. And so I think way before we confront these questions of true agency in robots, we're going to confront really interesting questions around, you know, fulfilling legal obligations, you know, not being able to predict autonomous agents, and we're going to be facing interesting issues around the way that people just react to something as though it were conscious, even when it isn't. You know, that there's a very interesting, you know, seminal critique of artificial intelligence by Joseph Weizenbaum, who designed the ELIZA program. That was the program readers probably know, or your listeners probably know. That was the program that used the Rogerian technique of psychotherapy, where it would just ask people questions. So it would say, you know, how do you feel about that? Or, that's interesting, say more. Just these really basic generic questions that are easy to program. People got so invested, they told this ELIZA program all kinds of crazy things, and they really reacted to it as though it were really a therapist, when all it was just a program, and not even a very sophisticated one. And Weizenbaum was so alarmed by people's reaction to ELIZA that he wrote this critique in the 70s of artificial intelligence that, you know, went through a lot of different issues. But one of the recurrent themes, I think, will be even more salient today, which was the fact that we just reacted to these things as though, you know, really they were people. And that, you know, that has all kinds of interesting ramifications, some that the law will be able to handle and other ones that it won't be able to inform at all.
One final question. How do you see the future of robots in the law?
So here's my hope. My hope is that the future of robots in the law is a future where some combination of state and federal lawmakers and the courts quickly sort out how to deal with the problem of multifunctional, very versatile robots where their behavior cannot be anticipated in advance. So my hope is that we're going to see a future where just like computers and the internet, people are building robots that can do anything you can imagine. And simultaneously, that the first time or the 20th time that a robot causes an injury or a robot causes damage to something, that we don't freak out, that we don't throw enormous damages at the individual, that it doesn't shut down the industry, that we've sorted it out in advance. And so that's one of my chief hopes. And so I think that the way that that'll happen is through, you know, argument, legal scholarship, through savvy courts sorting this stuff out, through Congress intervening in some instances. The second thing I hope with robotics and the law is that, you know, I hope that we get real sophisticated real soon about receiving robots into the world. My colleague Dan Siciliano, who's more of a corporate governance expert but also has been thinking quite deeply about robotics, points out the following. If we were to take just one task at a fast food restaurant in one state in the United States, and we were to turn it over to a robot, which is hardly impossible, right? I mean, I just heard about a bunch of delivery services, them firing a bunch of people at a hospital and hiring, quote-unquote, a bunch of robots in order to take over that function. But if we were to replace just one, say, fry cook with a robot, that would shift so much money from the payroll, which gets taxed differently, to capital expenditure, which you do on equipment. So much money would flow from payroll tax to another place that gets taxed differently, that it might destabilize the entire state's system. Little things like that, there are going to be more and more and more of those. And I'm hoping that today's students, today's lawyers, are starting to think about these ramifications so that they don't just cause wreak havoc all the time when they come surprise us. And so really it's an exercise in practical imagination, and that's where I see robotics in the law, I hope, evolving over the next few years.
Thanks, Ryan, for being here with us on Robots.
Thanks so much for having me.
With so many questions about the future, we couldn't resist putting up a poll to have your opinion. The question we're asking you today is, if robots become as intelligent as us, should they be considered as equal by the law? Yes or no? For more information on Ryan Kahlo and a link to his blog on robots and the law, have a look at our website at www.robotspodcast.com.
Thanks for listening. Hope to see you in 2 weeks.
Follow the Law with Robots, the podcast for news and views on robotics.